Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in Philosophy channel of the New Books Network. My name is Robert Talese, and I co-host the channel with Carrie Figter. In our bi-monthly podcast, we talk with philosophers about their newly published books. Today, I'll be talking with Professor Fabienne Peter about her new book, Democratic Legitimacy, which was published by Routledge. Fabienne is reader in philosophy at the University of Warwick. As a mode of social organization and a system of governance, democracy is hard to beat. In fact, right now, there are people in the world who are struggling at significant risk for democracy. But democracy is also hard to love, for democracy requires us to sometimes accept policies, laws, and decisions that we believe to be mistaken, suboptimal, imprudent, and even unjust. That is, we sometimes find ourselves on the losing side of a democratic vote, and when we lose, we must nevertheless live by the outcome that we opposed. Of course, democracy does not require us to be happy with its results, and it allows us to criticize, protest, and under certain circumstances even defy its rulings. But most of the time, we are required to accept the results of democratic decision-making, regardless of what our own individual judgments may be. Consequently, when democracy decides, even those who voted against the result are required to comply. And those who refuse to comply may be rightfully coerced into compliance. This is what we mean when we talk about the legitimacy of democratically produced collective decisions. They have a moral claim on us, even if we disagree with them. And this moral claim entitles democratic states to force compliance. What is the nature of this legitimacy? Is the simple fact that a majority voted for a particular decision sufficient to create for the minority a moral requirement to comply? What if the majority is misinformed, biased, bigoted, ignorant, deluded? Many contemporary democratic theorists have tried to explain the legitimacy of democratic outcomes by appealing to open public deliberation as a necessary precursor to voting. The idea is that democratic legitimacy derives not simply from the majority will, but from the fact that the majority will was formed under conditions under which citizens were able to consider the reasons and arguments relevant to the issue at hand. Deliberative democracy, then, introduces a reason-recognizing element into democratic politics. But we may ask whether this is a plausible conception of democracy. Perhaps it's too demanding to expect citizens to deliberate together. Fabienne Peter thinks that deliberative democracy is a plausible ideal. Let's turn to the interview. Hello, Fabienne Peter.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. Today on New Books in Philosophy, we're talking to Fabienne Peter about her new book, Democratic Legitimacy, which is published by Routledge. Democratic Legitimacy is, as the title suggests, very detailed and I think engaging exploration of the nature of democracy and the nature of the bindingness of democratically decided laws and policies. This is a fascinating subject, and I recommend the book highly. Now, Fabienne, before we get to discussing your book in particular, I'd like you to say a little bit about yourself, how you came to be interested in political philosophy and so on.
Well, thank you, first of all, for your kind invitation. And I came to philosophy through a lot of meandering. I grew up in Switzerland, which is a country, for better or worse, is very proud of its democratic tradition. So I guess I sort of have an element of my interest in democracy. But for a long time, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I ended up studying economics first. I had a major in economics and a minor in philosophy. But I was very disappointed with economics. It just didn't seem to satisfy, I guess, my argumentative mind. So I actually ended up spending more time reading philosophy. In particular, what I did, insofar as I studied any economics, was studying Arthur Sen's work. It took me a long time to realize that the reason why I was interested in Arthur Sen's work was because I was interested in philosophy, not the economics. So Sen was an absolutely crucial influence in my formative years. And I was very fortunate to spend a year at Harvard University under Marcia's supervision, so where I could benefit from his feedback, as well as talking to John Rawls. And I guess after that year, I was completely sold, and the interest in, deep interest in political philosophy hasn't left me since.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, I had known that you had some interactions with Rawls, and but I was not aware of the connection to Sen, although now that I am thinking about particularly Chapter 2 of your book, as we'll get to talk about it in a minute, that makes perfectly good sense. So let's not jump the gun, though, and let me now ask you particularly about Democratic Legitimacy, the book. So early in the book, in fact, on page 2, you say that the aim of the book is to, and here I'm quoting you, offer a systematic treatment of the requirements of democratic legitimacy. Now, without getting into the specifics of your own positive proposals just yet, we'll get to that in a minute, could you tell us a little bit, very generally now, about the problematic surrounding democratic legitimacy? This seems like it's likely to be a long-standing philosophical problem. What would you say are its most general contours?
Yeah, it's interesting to say it is a long-standing philosophical problem. Perhaps for many, it is an obvious problem for political philosophy. But in recent political philosophy, I think legitimacy has tended to be a bit in the shadow of justice. And that's to some extent simply due to the fantastic merits of Rawls' influential book, The Theory of Justice.
Right.
But so even though it is a long-standing problem, it seemed to me when I came to political philosophy that it wasn't understood quite as clearly as one might hope. In fact, as I'm sure you're aware, and everyone working on legitimacy and related concepts in political philosophy, it's a hopelessly messy concept.
Right.
So I think partly what I was trying to do in the book was to, just for myself, sort out what legitimacy is, how it should be understood, and specifically, what kind of normative requirements does it impose on us? So I have a normative understanding of legitimacy as opposed to the quite familiar Weberian conception of legitimacy, which is concerned with whether or not people believe that particular government or political institutions in general is or are legitimate. So on a broadly normative conception, legitimacy might relate to the justification of political power or the justification of political authority. Sometimes it's also connected to the justification of political obligation. There's a whole range of possible understandings of what legitimacy is. I think what I suppose, without getting into details of what I propose in the book, the focus of the book isn't so much on those debates, which are the traditional debates in political philosophy, but if we accept that democracy is an essential part of legitimacy, that is, that the justification of political authority or of political power is in some way linked to democracy, what exactly does democracy impose on us in the name of legitimacy? That is, I think, really the question the book tries to address.
Oh, I see. So the way the book proceeds, or the argument of the book proceeds, is that it begins with, and if I'm wrong, please correct me, it begins with the idea that if there is political legitimacy at all, democracy realizes it and then tries to work from that premise to some conception of what democracy must be. As a political order or as a set of practices in order for it to make good on its claim to legitimacy. Is that right?
That's right.
Good. Yeah. Oh, please continue. Yeah. And so do you see that as working in, I mean, it sounds to me like the book then works in a slightly different direction from some of the other and mainstream works on this sort, which tend to try to give a philosophical justification of the claim that democracy or democratically produced laws and policies can be legitimate. It seems to me like you begin from that premise and then try to work in the other direction. What must democracy be if that's going to be the case?
That's right.
Excellent.
Only a brief, basically, dismissal of what I call instrumentalist accounts of legitimacy, which treat them as relevant for legitimacy only to the extent that democracy achieves some other democracy-independent value. So I dismiss those and then focus directly on democracy democracy as a requirement of legitimacy, but exactly as you say, I don't discuss any particular justification for democracy, why democracy ought to be an essential part of legitimacy. I take that for granted for society like ours.
Can you say a little bit more about that particularly? I'm on your side on this debate that we don't need to start from scratch in trying to answer Plato's question, you know, which regime is best? Mm-hmm. But there are all kinds of motivations that seem to me perfectly reasonable that one might have for resisting that sort of Platonic approach. Aristotle too, you know, let's get a catalog of the regimes and see which one is best. But could you say something about your own motivations for adopting that that premise that democracy is already at least prima facie justified?
Yeah. The problems I have with those, it's perhaps really easiest to draw the distinction between democratic proceduralism and democratic instrumentalism. That is, those who only recognize an instrumental value of democracy, only if democracy realizes some non-democratic value, then they are prepared to accept the justification. So with regard to instrumentalism, it just seems to me, first of all, and I think you're on with me on that one as well,
yes.
We need to respect value pluralism. So the problem with any approach that starts with some non-democratic values, it's not quite obvious what these values are supposed to be, given that people have fundamentally different conceptions of the good. So the respect of value pluralism is, I take it, an important reason why, if we live insofar as a democratic regime is feasible, we ought to go for that, because no other regime is, it seems to me, quite as able to respect deep value pluralism. And the second
Excellent.
Reason I have for being drawn to the idea that democracy is, if it's feasible, important, is what I call Wisden, democracy's constructive function. So it's not only a way of sort of dealing with our value conflicts, it's also a way for learning about differences, the different circumstances in which we live. So that's the constructive function. It helps us understand our society. It helps us understand what kind of problems we might face. And that, too, I think, is very important value of democracy that I don't quite see how any other regime can satisfy.
Right. And that helps to introduce some of the epistemological dimensions of democracy that your own positive view tries to accommodate. But before getting to that, let me ask now a question about what might seem to our audience a very intuitive alternative conception of democracy, one that doesn't invoke deliberation and value pluralism and learning about others' value commitments and the rest. And this is what you call in the book aggregative democracy. And let me just say that it seems that one perhaps even popular conception of democracy is this what we might call the schoolyard view, where one person, one vote, and majority rules. And it seems like this view, which we might associate with what political theorists call the aggregative conception, seems like this has a certain intuitive pull because it doesn't involve or invoke all of the messiness about value commitments and reasons and all of the things that it looks like. And we'll get to talking about this in a second, the alternative deliberative conception invokes. So it's got a kind of simplicity to it that makes it very attractive, especially to people working on political theory from the political science end of things. The second chapter of your book contains or features a very sustained and I think a compelling set of arguments against this sort of straightforward popular view that democracy is simply each person gets a vote and then at the end of the day you add up the votes and the majority rules. Could you say something a little bit about why you think the various kinds of aggregative conceptions of democracy are inadequate?
Yes, I'm more than happy to, because in a way that's where this project started. Given my background in economics, my first formal training when it came to democratic thought was in social choice theory, that is the economic theory of democracy. And that was one of the fields that left me with a profound sense of dissatisfaction.
Right.
Theory was inadequate. And Well, what helped me to a degree was that in social choice theory, in fact, at the very beginning of social choice theory, is a very interesting result, which in itself seems to suggest that aggregate democracy is deeply flawed. And that's Arrow's famous impossibility theorem. So that theorem says that any collective decision-making mechanism that is non-dictatorial will fail to satisfy certain rationality conditions, or vice versa, a rational decision-making mechanism that produces rational results will end up being a dictatorship. So a deeply anti-democratic
result, right,
is what is called to be the economic, or supposed to be the economic theory of democracy. So that left me wondering. So not only was there something intuitively wrong with the theory, but also it seemed to in itself suggest that there is no such thing as democratic legitimacy. The way I think about Arrow's theorem is that it specifies conditions for democratic legitimacy, but then seems to sort of come back on itself by suggesting that these conditions cannot be simultaneously satisfied. So what's wrong with that approach to legitimacy? Well, a number of things. So one problem I think that aggregate democracy has is it cannot address any questions of justice. Amartya Sen has a very nice little example that highlights the problem. Aggregate democracy cannot distinguish between a situation where two people who already have a big share of the cake decide that they will take more cake from the person who has nothing or has very little. And the situation where two people who have hardly anything decide to take a bit more from the person who has the largest share. So aggregate democracy cannot distinguish between these two different problems, and yet they seem to us that when it comes to decision making, democratic decision making, this is the kind of problems we want to be able to distinguish between. We want to know it matters. It makes a difference for legitimacy whether a democratic collective decides makes a decision of type A versus a decision of type B.
Oh, absolutely, right.
Justice seems to be relevant, and aggregate democracy is blind to that. It is also blind to all sorts of problems that may arise with individual preference. Like you described, aggregate democracy is the notion that we make decisions by aggregating individual preferences. But all sorts of things can be wrong with individual preferences. They may just express very expensive taste. Someone just wants a lot for himself or herself, and it's not obvious that in a democracy we need to respond to that demand. Or they may reflect adaptive preferences. People have settled into their misery, have accepted their dim prospects, and again, and they vote or express views based on those preferences, not obvious that we should give them equal weight than someone who has sort of a fair assessment of what their share is. And so on. I mean, there are all sorts of problems that can go on with preferences. You can have bad preferences, antisocial preferences. And again, it's not obvious that a democracy should respond to them. So we want to have some sense of, well, what is it that you actually want? And aggregate democracy only seems to have the sense, well, one preference, one vote, right? And
right,
that seems insufficient.
Right. And does it seem to you, and I got a sense of this in the second chapter of Democratic Legitimacy, that even if it were the case that the aggregative conception could in some way respond to these very, it seems to me, formidable problems of rationality, the problems of expensive taste, the problems of uninformed tastes and preferences, even if it could somehow satisfy or respond in some philosophically compelling way to these problems, it's still aggregative democracy. That is, it still gives you a very weak conception of legitimacy. That is, when certain very important matters are at stake for a political community, and you vote your preference and your preference loses out, it might not be a very compelling answer if you were to ask the question, you know, why should I go along with what the majority says? It's not particularly compelling an answer to that question for someone to say, well, we all got one vote and we just, you know, that's how the vote went, right? But it seems that that might not give a reason of the right kind, as it were, to regard the outcome as binding.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the weak defense that comes out of Arrow's framework is, well, at least it's a rational social preference. That is, we didn't make any mistakes of consistency. We sort of ranked the alternatives consistently. Is, like you say, not very helpful here if what is ranked are in fact not good reasons for making any decisions.
Well, that seems right.
It doesn't seem to go very far.
Right. Now, picking up on this this kind of criticism about even if the aggregative view could satisfy some of the rationality problems, you still have a very weak conception because one man, one vote, majority rule doesn't really give minority voters, that is people who are on the minority position in the vote, much of a reason. So picking up on this idea of reasons, you favor some version of an alternative view of democratic legitimacy, which is generally called deliberative democracy. Now, as you spell out in your book, I think in very, very nice detail, there are all kinds of different views that claim this title. It's not clear, at least on first approach, that that all of the views that call themselves deliberative have some core doctrine. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. So given that there's so many different views, could you say something very general about what you think these views share? Is it a common philosophical doctrine? Is it just a common aversion to the aggregative view? Is it a common focus on reasons? So could you say something very general about deliberative democracy as an alternative way of conceiving of democratic legitimacy?
Absolutely. So in the first instance, perhaps what needs to be said, very often a contrast is made between aggregative democracy as the aggregation of preferences, aggregation of individual preferences, versus deliberative democracy as a way of making decisions by consensus. That's not how I draw the distinction. So even though some conceptions of deliberative democracy aim at consensus and hence regard majority rule, voting based on majority rule as insufficient, that doesn't quite strike me as the relevant contrast. So even in the deliberative democracy, where public discussion is highlighted, a consensus may still not arise, as I think we all know from public discussions. Consensus tends to be very rare. So some form of aggregation, some form of voting may still be required as a way of making decisions. But the key bit is that voting is not sufficient. So on a deliberative account of democracy, what is constitutive of democratic decision-making is that there is a process of public reasoning, so that's an exchange of reasons between the democratic subject. So it's not just reasoning per se, but it's reasoning amongst each other. I mean, it's reasoning between democratic agents. So there's an exchange of reasons between these agents and under conditions of political equality. So there's some sense of a process of exchange of reasons between agents viewed as equals. So the contrast with aggregative democracy is, first of all, that reasons replace preferences as the main input to democratic decision-making. So it's not simply I want A or I want B, but it's the kind of reasons one has for favoring A or B, which are the main input. But it's not just the reasons as such. Like I said, it's the reasons given by the agents participating, and hence there's a question of what kind of conditions are necessary that to make sure that these agents participate as equals. So compared to aggregative democracy, it's not just one person, one vote. We have to have some substantive conditions of being economically, socially, etc., so that one has equal standing in that collective reasoning process.
I see. So it deliberative democracy then is more concerned with the reflectiveness or the rationality or the reasonableness of the inputs that go into the more familiar mechanisms of democracy, voting and parliamentary procedures and all the rest. Is that right?
Yes. So the focus is really on reasoning agents as opposed to individuals as carriers of preferences, right? But that's the main contrast that I want to draw. And yes, because we're not just looking at individuals as carriers of preferences, the main explain input are the kind of reasons that these agents bring to the process.
And is there? I know that in many ways of spelling out the deliberative democracy position, there is an explicit claim made about how part of the deliberative process is supposed to be aimed at informing preferences and maybe even transforming or changing them. That is that the contrast between the deliberative view and the aggregative view is the aggregative view is interested in what we might call raw or just, you know, given preferences, whereas deliberativists, it seems to me, tend sometimes to invoke the idea, well, sure, we're talking about preferences, but they have to be rational or informed or driven by reasons and not simply just whatever the voter brings to election day or happens to bring to the vote, to the polls, rather, on that day. Does your view get into the specifics about the changing or transformation or the rational revision of preferences?
Yes, but with I just want to add one qualification to what you just said.
Sure.
Aggregate democracy can deal with, you know, revised preferences. The thing is, what it doesn't see is the difference between, you know, unexamined preferences and examined preferences. One can apply a majority rule to a set of examined preferences, right? And ideally, in a deliberative context, that's what happens. So the problem with aggregate democracy is not just that it can only handle given preferences. It can handle any preferences, or it aims to handle any preferences, but it can't see what the difference is between unexamined and examined preferences. And the advantage of deliberative democracy that it puts the emphasis on examining and, like you say, transforming preferences, it highlights why that is an important feature of democratic decision making. It matters which kind of preferences we aggregate in the end.
Right. While you were speaking just a minute ago about the deliberative model and about the treating citizens as rational agents and the emphasis on rational inputs into the democratic process, there was a lot of talk about reason and about reasons and reason giving. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the standard problems within even conceptions of democracy that are not full-bloodedly deliberative but do have a place for reasons and reason giving is this issue about the content of what we were calling a minute ago public reason, that is, reasons that can be shared or accessed or recognized by citizens as such. And I know that you have a full chapter in the book, Democratic Legitimacy, about the concept of public reason.
Yeah.
Now, there's a huge literature on this deriving from Rawls about what should count as a reason and what kinds of considerations can be reasons for you, but can't be reasons that count in the in public deliberation. Can you say a little bit about this problem and about your own approach to the content question about public reason?
Yes. It might be helpful to mention that Rawls' idea of public reason, to which you just referred, has received a lot of criticism, and I think sometimes for good reasons. And I want to draw a distinction between Rawls' idea of public reason as understood to apply to each and every decision made. So hence, that there's a certain, that we need to impose certain constraints on the kind of reasons that people can use when they try to argue for or against a particular proposal. I do not want to use that notion of public reason. I still use a lot of Rawls, but I don't use his idea of public reason in that way. He can sometimes be read as if he meant his idea of public reason to be understood that way, so that that we should be very limited in when we enter deliberation in terms of which reason we put forward. I think that's too limited. This view is too limited. When we deliberate collectively about which way to go, it will be inevitable that we will draw on all sorts of ideas of the good. That is, I think, what democracy is about. There's a fight among people about different interests, etc. And it's really crucial that these interests come to the table. I mean, I think it's an advantage of deliberative democracy that it can bring all interests and these and justifications for why these interests ought to be taken into account to the table. So this inclusiveness of deliberative democracy when it comes to interests and the justification of why these interests matter, I think, is a key advantage. So I wouldn't want to limit kind of reasons that can be brought to the table too much. At the same time, clearly, there must be certain limits. If people, that's, like I said, I think of a problem with aggregate democracy, if people simply come to the deliberative process by sort of very selfishly arguing for proposals that benefit them the most, that's probably not going to go very far. So there is, on the one hand, a certain constraint that's, or a certain set of constraints perhaps that need to be respected just in terms of, well, if reasoning together means certain things, one needs to address one's reasons to others, and hence that means the reasons have to have a form which makes them at least potentially acceptable to others, as opposed to just say, I want this or I want that. So that's one sort of set of constraints related to that thing. But then in terms of Rawls' idea of public reason, how much does it leave for that idea? Well, I think that one can use the idea of public reason, Rawls' idea of public reason, specifically to justify the constraints which shape the deliberative process as a whole. I call this the procedural interpretation of Rawls' idea of public reason. So the thought is, we need to, well, there are all sorts of possible democratic or processes, decision-making processes. So there needs to be a certain shared sense of what this process is. And that's, I think, where the idea of public reason comes in. So there needs to be a certain, I'd say almost consensual justification, or at least a reasonably consensual view about what these constraints are, so that we need to sort of be able to justify to each other in terms of public reason what an appropriately constrained deliberative process is. But what we don't need is to restrict ourselves that much that each and every decision within that process needs to be supported by only specific reasons that we all can share. So that's the difference between deliberative democracy as in as consensus overall, and deliberative democracy as being a more procedural view. The process needs to be appropriately constrained, and but there may not be consensus with regard to the justification for each and every decision made.
I see. So just picking up on that, could you say, so again, I think that the book has a quite lovely way of delineating and distinguishing different forms of deliberative democracy, different kinds of deliberative democracy from the point of view of proceduralism versus concerns with substance or outcomes. As I take it that many of our listeners would know, there is this longstanding debate among deliberative Democrats between sort of more proceduralist versus more substantive accounts of the view. And you invoke some very nice distinctions, I think, between pure proceduralism and other kinds of proceduralism. Could you say a little bit about the procedure-substance debate within deliberative democracy, and then some stuff, say some things about your own view on, particularly on that issue?
Well, the procedure-substance distinction is one which relates to the question of, well, what is it that democratic legitimacy requires from us? Is it sufficient that democratic decisions are made in the right way, through an appropriate procedure, or is it also necessary that the decisions themselves are somehow right? So are there only procedural constraints on democratic decision making, or is democratic legitimacy a concept that combines considerations of procedure and substance? In other words, is it important for legitimacy that the decision isn't just the outcome of an appropriate procedure? It is important also that the decision itself satisfies certain procedure independent values.
Right.
So I use this distinction So what I do in the book, and I think it's sort of the core idea of the book, that we can distinguish conceptions of democratic legitimacy, not just depending on what are essential features of democracy, but also what kind of categories of normative requirements do we want to impose in the name of democracy? So this gets me to, in the simple form, a 2x2 matrix, or which can then be extended to a 2x3 matrix. So we have aggregative versus deliberative democracy when it comes to the question, what are essential features of democracy? And we have pure proceduralism versus what I call rational proceduralism when it comes to the question, what are categories of requirements that we want to impose on democratic decision-making? According to pure proceduralist conception, it is sufficient for a decision to be legitimate if the decision has been made in the right way. So only certain procedural constraints apply. These are typically some constraints of equality, some form of political fairness. For rational proceduralist conceptions of legitimacy, that's not enough. So on those views, a democratic decision is legitimate if it is the outcome of an appropriately constrained procedure and if the decision satisfies certain additional values, certain values that I call, that refer to political quality. So on rational proceduralist accounts, democratic legitimacy combines conditions of both political equality and political quality. Okay, we can then enhance or add to that matrix by distinguishing a further conception of democracy, not just aggregative and deliberative, but also epistemic democracy. That's, as you, of course, are aware as well, an idea many people currently are interested in. So the idea that democracy isn't just about deciding which values matter or which preferences matter, but also it's also a way of comparing belief. That's the idea of the standing democracy, and we can then, by adding that column, we get further two categories, pure epistemic proceduralism and rational epistemic proceduralism. So that's the sort of organizing matrix for the whole of the book.
And am I right to think that your own position is a kind of deliberative democracy that is both procedural, I mean, that is, and combines procedure and substance, but also has this epistemic element as well? Is that right?
Sorry, did I just lose you?
So can you say something about the epistemic dimension of this? Because certainly our audience will have the usual reaction that people have once you start talking about democracy as having some epistemic constraint, either in the input part of the or the output part. That is that the specter of anti-democratic Plato and others looms, where once one starts talking about democracy as having an epistemic dimension, people typically think of rule of experts or philosopher kings, or even more modest proposals that still seem objectionable, like John Stuart Mill's plural voting scheme, where the smarter people are supposed to get more votes than those who didn't graduate from university. So could you say a little bit about what the epistemic dimension is, and then maybe say something about why you think, as I take it you do think, that these sort of concerns about rule by experts are addressable, or aren't as don't cut as deeply into your position as one might think upon first hearing it.
Yeah, well, I certainly share these reservations that you just mentioned, or this unease perhaps about any such idea that democracy or that the political regime ought to aim after truth. Let's put it that way. I certainly share and unease about that suggestion. Now, in what I call the standard account of epistemic democracy, the thought is that we should evaluate alternative democratic decision-making procedures in terms of how well they track the truth. So this is an explicit linking of democratic decision-making with aiming for a procedure-independently defined correct outcome. So the thought is different democratic decision-making procedures will be more or less likely to get it right. That is the standard view of epistemic democracy. That's the view many are drawn to today, and indeed it has received the stellar defense, I have to say, from David Esslund in his book, Democratic Authority.
Right.
Even though I have a great admiration for his book, I still think he's wrong. And I think he's wrong because I still do not believe that this idea of democracy or any political regime as a truth tracker will get us very far. In fact, I think the standard notion of epistemic democracy, of democracy as a truth tracker, is normatively misleading. I also think it's not necessary. We can achieve what are valid aims of those going to epistemic democracy in a less demanding and, I think, less problematic fashion. I think we can take a pure proceduralist approach which still respects epistemic value, which still respects the idea that democracy can be seen as a procedure that evaluates belief as opposed to just preferences, so that there is epistemic value to the democratic process, but without that idea of a procedure-independent outcome, and has less problematic. I don't think we need to go that far. We don't need to postulate this correct outcome in order to see that democracy has epistemic value.
And are your reservations about these more heavily epistemic views, like David Esslund's, for example, are they driven by a concern once we think of collective decision as aimed at some procedure-independent epistemic goal, then democracy is just not going to be able to deliver the goods? Or do you think that there's some reason to wonder about the very claim that democratic outcomes could be evaluable in epistemic terms, true, false, more wise, less wise? I mean, what exactly, I mean, apart from just the obvious worry about, Platonic philosopher kings or rule by experts, do you see any other concerns about a heavier epistemic view, namely that it's the democracy can't do it, or maybe no political process could do it, or that maybe there's nothing to be done in the first place because these aren't the kinds of entities that can be evaluated in those kinds of heavy epistemic terms?
I probably would endorse much of what you just said, but that's not the main worry that I address in the book. Charge them with, or what I specifically bring forward against David Esslund's epistemic account of democratic legitimacy, is that in a sense it's not epistemic enough, right? It overlooks an important epistemic value, an important way in which democracy is epistemic, and that relates to the way in which we learn from each other. Now, as you, of course, know, in fact, and know much better than me, because you specialize in the fact of this tradition, that's also a key thought in that particular tradition of thinking about democracy, that the democratic process is one in which we learn from each other, and indeed, there is no idea of correct or good outcome independently of one that we identify collectively through democratic decision-making procedures. Now, I very much share that intuition. So, when you ask me whether my worry with the standard approach to epistemic democracy is that it's sort of too epistemically loaded, no, it's in a way the opposite. It overlooks the way in which the democratic process is epistemically loaded. I do take this learning procedure to be a very important value of democracy, or the way in which democracy contributes to learning to be a very important feature of democracy, and indeed one that I think is connected to legitimacy. If a democratic process is not geared towards learning from luckier towards us learning from each other, I think it has a problem with legitimacy.
Oh, I see. So now that's very interesting, and you're right. I picked up on this in reading the book. It's glad to hear you affirm it, that there was a kind of pragmatist set of intuitions driving your positive view, and the way that you put it, I think is very, very helpful, that democracy also has to account for or accommodate or conceptualize the ways in which democracy is about sharing information or some kind of collective epistemic enterprise. Let me just raise sort of one, again, just as once you start talking about democracy having epistemic constraints, people start having those Platonic worries. Let me just raise one sort of possible concern that one might have in light of what you just said about your positive commitments about democracy being in part a collective learning exercise. Mm-hmm. So one might worry that then democracy becomes modeled too closely on the philosophy seminar. That is that democratic communities are not just communities in which people go and they think about either what they want or what the public good requires, or they do some reading of newspapers or listening to talk radio or whatever, and then go and vote. But if democracy has this interpersonal connection or component of learning about each other and learning about each other's views and reasons, some might say, well, I don't want to know that much about my neighbors. Right. I like my privacy. I don't want to reveal that much to people, even if they happen to be my democratic compatriots. Could you say a little something about how heavy a commitment this is to sort of collective learning, if that's at the center of democracy? Is it does that require a lot of us, or is it something that's more minimal than it may sound?
Yes, I think it is more minimal than you may sound.
Excellent.
I can sort of give you a personal anecdote to undermine that. I escaped Switzerland, which I consider to be a country that is very meddlesome. Yes, it's democratic, but it's also very meddlesome. People do tend to have a lot of views about what other people are supposed to be doing. And I escaped from that to England, which is very well known for its emphasis on privacy. So I kind of prefer that. But I don't see that that is an issue that needs to necessarily prejudices for against democracy. As a democracy, one can decide, or a country can decide, that privacy is an important good. Right? I see no reason why democracy has to come with meddlesome preferences, to use a term from socialist literature. So it is more minimal than it may sound, because this learning I take this learning again to be a procedural virtue. So it's not so much in terms of how much information we go out and gather in terms of producing certain good outcomes. The idea is really that we can't decide what, say, a just the most just policy option is, or the best policy option is, without recognizing how people are affected by a particular decision. So it's not so much about whether people should have views about each other, but it's really about, well, do we really understand the policy that we're supposed to be making a decision about? Right? And I'd say democracy is an important way in which we learn about what are we talking about? What are the policies we're actually considering?
Excellent, excellent. So one last question, and we've taken up a lot of your time, and this has been great fun, and thank you for talking to us about your book, Democratic Legitimacy. So what are you working on now? What's the next project? Where do things go from here?
Well, I'm still working on legitimacy, believe it or not.
Excellent.
But the book is concerned with the question, or is trying to show that procedural values are sufficient for democratic legitimacy, right, or for legitimacy then. Pure proceduralism against this tendency of people to think that rational proceduralism, the quality of decision matters, I tend to argue, no, actually, you know, a pure proceduralist approach is sufficient. So now I'm now interested in the question is, well, how can I show that it is actually necessary? So why are procedural values necessary for democratic legitimacy? Why is public justification necessary for legitimacy? And I've now moved into epistemology, more so than in the book, in the sense that a key idea of Rawls' political liberalism is that we cannot justify political institutions or political decisions to each other if we argue from within particular comprehensive doctrines, as he calls it. And I'm interested in the question, well, why not? What's the issue here? And what I'm doing is I look at the epistemology of disagreement and into the question, well, what is, if there is such a thing at all, a reasonable disagreement? Is it possible that two people can each be justified to hold what turns out to be mutually incompatible beliefs? Some people in the literature argue, well, that's not possible, right?
Right.
Only mere disagreement. There's no such thing as a reasonable disagreement. But I want to argue, I mean, I'm not the only one, thank God. I'm using in the literature who argue that there is such a thing as a reasonable disagreement. There are explanations for why it is possible that people can hold, with good reasons, mutually incompatible beliefs. I want to show that, first of all, how to understand that possibility and then link it back to political philosophy. So I get, in a sense, a deeper understanding of the ideas behind political liberalism by starting from epistemology. And what I find interesting about that project is much political philosophy in recent years, post-Rawls, has tended to emphasize very much the moral component, as even associated political philosophy with moral philosophy, treated political philosophy as a branch of applied ethics. Because of the worries that I already expressed in the book and that we share about the depth of value pluralism that we encounter in our societies, that doesn't strike me quite satisfactory. So I want to start with sort of the epistemic underpinnings of the possibility of a reasonable disagreement.
Well, that sounds very exciting. So we'll look forward to that next project. I find it really one of the real exciting aspects of current political philosophy is this sort of overlap between longstanding mainstream concerns about legitimacy, authority, consent, coercion, freedom, with these epistemic concerns. And I very much look forward to seeing more from you along those lines. Thank you so much, Fabian, for talking to us. The book, again, is Democratic Legitimacy, published by Routledge. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Okay, bye-bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to my interview with Professor Fabian Peter of the University of Warwick. We've been talking about her new book, Democratic Legitimacy, published by Routledge. I'm Robert Talish, your host. This is New Books in Philosophy. Thank you for listening.